You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ho, 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 hello, and welcome back to Bah Humbug, the Christmas movies podcast that decked the halls heavily with boughs of holly and now finds it quite hard to get into the kitchen. I'm your host, Helen O'Hara, and today I'm looking at Last Train to Christmas, which is a new time-travelling and train-travelling Christmas movie on Sky Cinema. Now, I know what you're thinking, and no, this is not about the mysterious ability of British Rail to never get you where you're meant to be going on time, basically ever. It is, in fact, the story of a man called Tony Towers, who's played by Michael Sheen, who's a wheeler and a dealer headed home for Christmas with his much younger fiancée, played by Natalie Emmanuel, and also his brother Roger, who's played by Cary Elwes. Now, Tony is a big shot, in his own mind at least, but his life isn't quite as under control as he likes to suggest on the outside. And he suddenly finds on this train that as he moves forward and backwards through the carriages of the train, it takes him forwards and backwards in time through his own life. That means that he can change his life completely with a single tiny tweak in the years past, based on the outcome in the years still to come. So it's a premise that you could maybe describe as a man meeting not the ghosts, but the carriages of Christmas past, Christmas present, and Christmas future. But this isn't just a railroad spin on A Christmas Carol, I promise. We have had every possible spin on A Christmas Carol that there could ever be, and I'm sure we'll still get many more besides. But this film is a slightly stranger beast, because Tony isn't a terrible miser to begin with, and much of what he learns concerns not only himself, but actually members of his family, friends, people around him. So it does turn out to be a rather different movie than the one you probably think you're going to be watching based on the synopsis alone. While the result is scrappy and, I'll be honest, a bit chaotic at times, it's also genuinely quite original in a way that I appreciated. And I think Michael Sheen is fantastic in it because, you know, he's Michael Sheen. So I was delighted to sit down recently for a short interview with Michael Sheen, who you know, of course, from the likes of the Underworld movies, from Frost Nixon, and from TV's Good Omens, season two of which, by the way, he's right in the middle of shooting. So as we spoke, he had that crazy Aziraphale hair. So here's what Michael had to say about Last Train to Christmas, about Christmas in general, and about his own Christmas traditions. Please enjoy.
Hi.
Hello, hello. How are you?
Good. Good. Thank you. Yeah, good.
Are you perhaps in Good Omens mode at the moment?
I am, yes. I just finished filming for Christmas day before yesterday.
Fantastic.
And so, yes, that's why I've got the hair.
Yeah. Very distinctive. Love it. Can't wait for season two.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, so we should, I mean, this is obviously a Christmas movies podcast, so we should talk about Last Train to Christmas. Are you a fan of Christmas movies in general? Is this something that, is this an itch that you've been waiting to scratch?
I very much so. I am a huge fan of both Christmas films and just Christmas generally. I do love Christmas, yes. And love Christmas films. I've always wanted to do a Christmas film. It's just never come up before. It never has. And the fact that this one is not only a Christmas film, also a time travel film, which I'm always, I'm also a massive fan of, and I love trains, I mean, it's ticking all the boxes for me, to be honest with you.
That's ludicrously on point.
It really is.
That's absolutely meant to be.
It was sort of written for me. So, you know, like Julian Kemp, who's the writer-director, we've been best mates since we were in drama school together. And and Julian does say that he kind of wrote it with an eye to, you know, me doing it. So I know he's leaned into things that he knows that I'm into. It's very unfair, really.
It doesn't give you much choice at the end of the day, does it?
No, exactly.
You've kind of got to say yes at that point.
Yeah. Although when a script does come along from someone who's a good friend, you know, I mean, that is a scary thing because you think, what if it's absolutely rubbish? But fortunately, this wasn't. It was marvelous.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was not quite what I was expecting either. I thought it was a bit clever and a bit more sort of sideways on than the film I was expecting to see when it began.
Yes, it sort of lulls you into thinking that it's going to be something that actually it sort of takes a different turn, doesn't it? The characters you meet at the beginning, you know, my character Tony, Sue, and the situation in a way, similarly, lends itself to stereotypes maybe, you know, makes you think, oh, I know who these people are. I know what this relationship is and I know what this film is. And I think in the same way as the film kind of takes you somewhere that you weren't expecting, I think you also start to discover that these people are not what you thought. And I don't mean like, oh, they've got secrets. I mean, they're just more complicated and complex and rich and full of, you know, paradoxes and contradictions than, like, you know, people are.
Yeah.
And so I liked that about it. I really liked that it did that and that it played with things that are familiar, not only the characters, like I say, in the situation, but also the fact that in the tradition of a lot of Christmas films, certainly some of the more successful stories that have stayed around, like your Scrooges, your Christmas Carols and your It's a Wonderful Lives, you know, it's someone having the chance to revisit their life, go on a tour of their life, be taken and shown their life in a way that, you know, maybe they hadn't quite taken on board before, and seeing the consequences of their actions. And in this case, actually trying to change that and make changes. And I like that, the familiarity of that. I thought that was strong. And at the same time, something that's very unusual and very different to a lot of other Christmas films, and the sort of character that goes on that journey. I like that combination of things. I thought that was very both clever and kind of moving as well. You know, I thought that was
quite
powerful.
Yeah, it was moving. Yeah. Mm. And in a way I didn't expect, because I thought it was going to be a fairly simple, instead of ghosts of Christmas, past, present and future, carriages of Christmas, past, present and future.
Yeah.
But because he can change things by moving through the carriages and acting differently, everything keeps shifting and the ground keeps changing under him. And it sort of introduces this element of, I guess, chaos that we don't really have in any of those other stories.
Yeah, exactly. I was very struck as we were filming. Something that started to sort of become an obsession in a way was thinking about the randomness of our lives. You know, what appear, you know, obviously because we, as far as we know, choose one path, unless you, you know, subscribe to the multiverse theory and all that stuff. But, you know,
I saw Spider-Man last night. So, yeah, exactly.
We can only be aware consciously of one path that we've taken. So it somehow seems quite neat in retrospect in a way. But when you actually look at it and think about it, you think, well, those people who became most important in my life, other than family, I guess, I could easily have not met them. If I'd left the house a minute later, or if I'd made that slight different choice or that different decision, it could have all been so different. And the sense of randomness and chaos that we're living in. And then you think, well, is there a kind of a guiding hand? Because when you look back, our brains are made to see patterns, I suppose, recognize patterns, even when they're not there. Hence all kinds of bizarre conspiracy theories. But recognizing the patterns in your life and, you know, I guess psychotherapy is all based on that, isn't it? And and realizing that it's not as random. It's nowhere near as random. There is randomness there. There is chaos there. But we are constantly forming patterns out of that chaos. We're creating meaning out of meaninglessness, potentially, I suppose. And so there's some sort of push-me-pull-you thing going on. Bring up another film that's quite popular at Christmas time, although it's not a Christmas film. Yeah, so I found that really fascinating as well. You know, when you do look back, you think, oh, it could have all been so different, couldn't it?
Yeah, it could. And yet there are these, not say patterns, but there are these kind of habits. So you do tend to take the train home, or in my case, the plane home or whatever, every Christmas, you know, so it does still kind of fit that it would. This particular thing would be repeated every year, and there would be a sort of a model there.
I suppose there's something inherently about Christmas that lends itself to things that I think have become very popular tropes in Christmas films, in that, you know, just in life, you come around to Christmas every year. So there's a sense of you can mark a life through Christmases, and therefore you can't help but think about Christmases past each Christmas. So, you know, the ghost of Christmas past is always with you, because you kind of go, well, remember this Christmas last year, you know, Nana was still with us, or whatever it might be. You know, like you can see that, and it marks the passage of time anyway. I think partly why I like time travel things is because of the melancholy in it, the sadness in it, because there is in the best of time travel films, like, I don't know, 12 Monkeys and, you know, whatever it might be, Back to the Future even, there is a sort of there's something in there about the passing of time that I find incredibly moving. My favorite of the Back to the Future time travel films is the second one, where you're able to watch things from the first one from a different point of view. There's something that goes very deep about that, I think. So there is something quite moving about time travel in itself, but I think it's the same thing that's quite moving about Christmas. And it is that sense of marking and looking back and getting a moment where you do take stock a little bit and think about the consequences of choices and, oh, it could have been different. And it, you know, it's not a coincidence, obviously, that then within a week you're making New Year's resolutions. It's about the future based on whatever, you know, nightmare you've had over Christmas. You go, well, this is how I'm going to do it from now on. So there, you can see why Christmas Carol, Scrooge, that story strikes a real chord with us, because it's a metaphor for itself, you know, if that's even possible. But it does kind of reflect what we all go through at Christmas time, I think. And that sense of possibility, you know, the moments, that pivotal moment between the then and the still to be, there's a kind of a sense of possibility. And there's something about Christmas that somehow, I think, can appeal to what is best in us, you know, that we can be more than what we have been in this moment. This allows us the opportunity to go beyond ourselves, to transcend ourselves somehow, and makes us feel connected to something bigger than ourselves. And I don't just mean that in a religious sense, but in a community sense as well. You know, whatever it works for you, whatever's bigger than you, whatever you can relate to, that is sort of, that takes the onus off you and what you want and what you need. At Christmas, that seems to kind of be very powerful and kind of resonate for people a bit more. And so you can see why those stories like It's a Wonderful Life and Christmas Carol can kind of have really tapped into that. Yeah. And we do as well, I suppose, in this film, but in a very, very different way, but with mullets.
Yes. I mean, the hair is something I was going to ask about. Did you, you have many different hairstyles throughout this film, some of them extraordinary. Did you have a favourite?
Oh dear. Well, I mean, the favorite, I suppose, is the first one we see, the sort of baseline version of Tony Towers in 1985 with the full on Stringfellow. That is a strong look, and it's got, so, you know, I grew up in the 80s. I was born in 69, so I was what, you know, 11 at the beginning of the 80s. So it was my formative years, teenage years. So that, just that look, presses all kinds of buttons in me. You know, I'm suddenly listening to Never Ending Story, you know, or whatever, you know, all those things. It's all in there. So I love that. But the look, I have to say, the look that made Julian laugh the most, because every day I would come out of the hair and makeup trailer and there'd be people who would gather round ready to, because we'd sort of just make it up, you know, that it was all planned. But in terms of what the look was actually going to be, it sort of happened in the trailer that day. So the one that made Julian laugh the most was the alternative version of Tony from the 80s, where he's a radio DJ and he's got the Radio Trent sweatshirt on, and the hair is sort of based on some kind of weird love child of Noel Edmonds and Mike Reed from the 80s. And I've got like, and I always remember from Radio 1 road shows, and they'd always wear like tiny little white skimpy tennis shorts.
Such short shorts.
Oh, yeah. Such short shorts. And so that look with that hair and the glasses, it was only when I put the Steve Wright glasses on that it all came together. But I remember walking out of the trailer that day and Julian practically fell over that day. And you think there's a lot more extreme looks going on there in that film, but that one for some reason really tickled him. So that was a favourite as well.
Yeah, that was fantastic.
Hi, everybody. My name's Helen.
And I'm Kobe.
And we're from Flixwatcher, a podcast in the Strip Media family.
We are a movie podcast and we review films that are just on Netflix in the UK.
So if you've ever struggled to find a film on Netflix to watch, we're the podcast for you.
We have guests on from other podcasts, big and small, just like these guys that you listen to now. They choose the films and we rate them and discuss them with our unique scoring system.
You can find Flix Watcher on any podcast app by searching Flix Watcher. That's F-L-I-X Watcher.
And if you want more information about any of the other podcasts in the Strip Media family, just visit www.stripped.media to find out more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Tony Towers, we should talk about him because, you know, you talk about Christmas being a time to kind of take stock and you know, look beyond yourself. And it strikes me that he is not a guy who has stopped very much in his life to the point where we meet him. He has just kind of plowed ahead.
Exactly. Yes. It's not that he's a bad man in any way. He's not Scrooge. You know, he's not someone who's being mean to people and has to be changed. But he's someone who has not thought really much about consequences or the choices he's made. He is, you know, in one way, he's very much in the moment. He's, you know, probably not in the kind of positive way that people talk about being in the moment, not in a Buddhist way or anything, but he is sort of just about the now and having fun. And at one point he says, I just want people to have fun, you know, that's all I want. And I think that is true. He doesn't really think too much about it. So he's sort of perfect to be put on this, you know, in this weird situation because he's not really spent much time reflecting. So getting to see what are the consequences of the choices he's made and then giving him the opportunity to make changes. And that's, I suppose, the thing that's different, isn't it? In the kind of classic Christmas versions of this, they don't change anything. I mean, Scrooge just, that's the awful thing for Scrooge, I suppose, isn't it? Is that he gets to see it and learn from it and discover what he did, but he can't do anything about it. He has to do something back in the present day again, doesn't he? And the same with Jimmy Stewart, I suppose, in It's a Wonderful Life. He sees an alternative version, but he can't change it. He can only go back to the present day and sort of reevaluate, I suppose. But Tony gets to be able to actually make changes. And that's when it starts to go into like Back to the Future territory, I suppose. And but we really go in there. I mean, most time travel films, I think, tend to, you know, that you have to deal with the, oh, if we change this and the butterfly effect and all that. They go into that, but they don't really, really go into it. They don't go, right, and chaos happens. And like now his whole life is different. And we really do go into that. For better or for worse, we go in there. And I love that about it. I love the sort of the courageousness or the stupidity of going, you know, that thing that people skirt around in time travel? Let's really go in there. So that's the slightly different thing. But I do love that. It does touch then on how interconnected everything is in our lives. You know, it seems random, it seems chaos, but everything is connected. And again, I think there's something very, for me, very touching about that, that not only is one person's life, all the things in one person's life interconnected, but we are all interconnected. You know, that sense of us being a community. And I think the importance, anything that you know, spotlights the importance of, you know, your actions. I mean, this is very It's a Wonderful Life, that the actions of one person can have such an effect on a whole community of people, you know, whether you're aware of it or not, for better or for worse. And it's the same for your own life, that, you know, your choices you make. And there's, I suppose, a key moment in our film is when Tony says to his brother Roger, he says, you know, the important thing is the choices you make right now, today. And he knows that because he's seen what's going to happen to Roger in the future. And you know, so he's coming at it from a slightly different point of view. But he's, you know, it resonates for us, I think, in that, you know, if you spend too much time in the future or the past in your head, you can lose the importance of the moment. And that's what I mean, I suppose, about Tony coming to understand something a bit different about what being in the moment is.
Yeah. I mean, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but the credits on this film have a rather Bondian promise that Tony Towers will return.
I know. I saw that. I was like, hang on. What? Hey, Julian? What? Well, what I will say is that we had a conversation. I mean, me and Julian, when we were filming, would have lots of conversations about the ramifications of what we were doing, you know, and the story and stuff. But we did have we did talk about the idea, well, and I'm going to try and say this in a way that's not a spoiler. It's an uplifting ending. It's an upbeat ending. But there's another way of looking at it going, but hang on, where's Tony's life gone? And so where he gets to at the end, I can only imagine that he would want to go back again.
Right, yeah.
And or it would be very difficult to resist the temptation to go back again because of the way things resolve themselves in this film. And so, you know, there is obviously the possibility of, there's a whole other, I mean, for a film that's about multiple paths in life, there's always more to explore, isn't there? So we'll see how it goes.
I have to ask as well about, there's a song in the film because there's a musical element here, some songwriting, a song called Eagles of Love.
Yes.
Now, Joe,
The original version was Seagulls of Love, but it gets changed to Eagles of Love. And we see the moment that happens. Yeah.
I think it's a shame. I don't think
Me
seagulls
too.
Get enough love.
Exactly.
Really.
I want to hear the song Seagulls of Love making it in the charts.
But yeah, who sang that? Because it's credited to Joe Soap, but I don't think that's a real name, is it?
All right. Well, it was written, maybe there's a reason, maybe I'm not supposed to say. Well, it was written by someone who writes a lot of stuff for people like Liam Gallagher and people like that. So it's someone, you know, someone who knows what they're doing. And there was talk at one point of, you know, a Christmas single, but that, unfortunately, the only person who was talking about that was me. So that didn't happen. But it's a great song. And there's a bit in the story, well, part of the story revolves around me and my brother at one point, and in one version of my life, of Tony's life, become sort of pop stars, I suppose. And they have this big hit, Eagles of Love. And my brother may be more talented than me, and yet it doesn't sort of get presented like that. So in the film, you see us coming up with the song. Roger coming up with the song. And then later on in the film, you hear me singing it. And I'm supposed to sing it really badly. And so I said to Julian, I came in on the day they were filming the bit where my brother comes up with the song. And I said to Julian, I should now not listen to it ever again. So that when we come to do the scene where I have to sing it, I just have to remember. Because Tony in the film, the version of Tony that's going through time, he only hears it once. You know, in the version of his life where, so when he has to sing it, he can't remember it. So we did do that. And I just sounded like John Shuttleworth when I was singing it. That was all I had going through my head was a John Shuttleworth song. So that scene, the scene where you hear me singing it, I really am genuinely not having a clue what I'm doing. Yeah.
Listen, I have to wrap up, but there's a couple of questions that we ask everybody. They're very quick fire, so I'm just going to finish with those. First of all, what is your favorite Christmas movie apart from this one?
It's a Wonderful Life.
Correct answer, yes. Mm. Well done.
Although strong competition from Elf.
Sure.
Over the last few years, I've started to, but yeah, It's a Wonderful Life. I don't think that will ever be knocked off the perch.
Correct. And is there an unusual Christmas tradition in your house? Do you have to open a present on Christmas Eve? Is there a particular kind of food that you always have to eat? What do you do at Christmas?
Well, Christmas traditions for me are a slightly strange thing because I have lived in so many different places and had so many different versions of a home life that traditions have not really been able to do. So I always think of traditions from when I was growing up, you know, the things that I did. And the strongest one, the strongest memory of a tradition is Christmas morning. Me and my sister coming downstairs, and we weren't allowed to go in the room. Does everyone call it the room? Yeah. You weren't allowed to go into the room until my dad had finished his breakfast. And I think this started off with coming from my mum to make sure that we had at least some version of breakfast before we shoved, you know, tons of chocolate into every orifice we had. And so it started off as a good thing. My dad, I think, slowly mutated it into torture. I mean, literal torture. So my dad would go, I am still eating my cornflakes, Michael. And then we'd be like, oh, come on, Dad, come on. And then he would go, and now I'm having a cigar. And he would just torture us until eventually Mum would go, go on, go in, let him in, my Rick, let him in. And that, so that's, weirdly, the biggest, strongest Christmas tradition I have is essentially based on the psychological torture of young children.
It's pain.
That's, yeah, yeah.
What a note to end on. Well, listen, thank you so much. And best of luck with, obviously, Good Omens Season 2 and congratulations on the movie.
Thank you so much. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Well, that's it for this episode of Bah Humbug. Please join us next time for more Christmas movies madness. In the meantime, I've been your host, Helen O'Hara. This podcast is edited by Ben Williams and produced by Kobe Omanaka for Stripped Media. And if you've enjoyed the pod, please do rate us with 5 shiny Christmas stars wherever you listen to your podcasts. But whatever you do, happy holidays!
Just heard a Stripped Media production.